you open to that page in your notes, I've kind of got two different types of notes that deal with this, but the traditional arguments for God's existence, some of them would be like the cosmological argument. A real common form of this is called the Kalam cosmological argument. It argues whatever has a beginning needs a cause. The universe had a beginning, therefore the universe needs a cause. And that the first cause of the universe must be eternal. I'm just going to run through these, and then when I'm starting to get away from them as specific arguments, and I'm beginning to look at them, these different aspects of human experience, more along the lines of clues left to us by God of His existence. Romans 1, verses 18 and 22 is a good passage to look at, because there it basically tells us that we have not seen the invisible God, but we have seen His visible creation, the work of His hand. Therefore, we know the Creator exists. And then in Romans 2, 14 and 15, we're told that even the Gentiles, even the pagans who don't have God's laws written on tablets of stone or in the Old Testament, they have God's laws written on their hearts. Their conscience is bearing witness and letting them know when they do the wrong thing. So basically, God has revealed, He gives us clues of His existence in creation. We don't see the Creator, but we see the creation, the work of His hands, so we know the Creator exists. It's like, I didn't see the pulpit maker, but I know He must exist because I see the work of His hands, God, we know that we've wronged God. You could sin all alone, no one watching you. You sin and you feel like you've offended someone because you've offended the all-seeing God. There's little hints of God's existence, clues that I think anything other than acknowledging the existence of God does not explain the data in question. Whatever the case, I'll give you just a few of the different types of traditional arguments. The cosmological argument argues from cause and effect. Cosmos is the Greek word for the world or the universe. The universe had a beginning and therefore needs a cause. The moral argument, there are eternal, unchanging moral laws, and therefore, above man, and this implies that the existence of an eternal, unchanging moral lawgiver above man. Teleological argument, the design and order in the universe show that the universe needs an intelligent designer. The argument from religious experience, all men sense a need for God. Even atheists like Jean-Paul Sartre acknowledged that the universal thirst for God. You can see that in their writings, the thirst, the desire to transcend. Even atheist Karl Marx wanted to bring about the classless society, the utopian society. It was an attempt to bring about that which is outside of man's reach. And the absurdity of life without God. If God does not exist, then life is without meaning. Morality is not ultimately real. There's no life after death, no punishments and rewards, no ultimate defeat of evil. Augustine argued from eternal unchanging ideas like mathematical proofs, 1 + 1 = 2, that these eternal unchanging ideas, there was never a time when they were not true, and they cannot come from time-bound changing minds. Therefore, there must exist an eternal unchanging mind as the cause for these eternal unchanging ideas. Kind of like he held to the Platonic ideas, and he was followed Plato on this. But okay, we see chairs, and Plato would say all particular individual chairs, they are not as real as the ideal chair, the the invisible, unchanging idea share, and we recognize them as shares because they share in that eternal idea. Now, Augustine would say, well, the physical realm is not less than real, less than fully real, because God created it, but he did believe that there are eternal, unchanging ideas. And I think Augustine would agree with me on this, that when the first human being invented a chair, it was not an idea that God didn't already know about. It wasn't like God said, oh wow, idea for a chair, I never thought of that. Now I've got this idea, this chair, that God foreknew all this, and so he had these eternal, unchanging ideas. Well, Augustine agreed with Plato that there were these eternal, unchanging ideas like goodness, beauty, truth, chair, things of that sort. But he said that they make no sense to have all these ideas hanging there on nothing. Ideas only make sense in a mind. Minds have ideas, and our time-bound, changing minds often make mistakes. We often add 1 + 1, and we come up with 3. And so the eternal, unchanging truth that 1 + 1 = 2 stands in judgment on our mistake there. So you say, well, the source of these eternal, unchanging ideas must be an eternal, unchanging mind. Now, what I do is I take some of these traditional arguments for God's existence, plus other clues, and I try to build a cumulative case for God. I argue that I treat Christian theism as a hypothesis, an explanation, a proposed worldview, and then I argue that it's, when you look at these different aspects of human experience, it's more reasonable to believe in God than to be an atheist. So I argue that theism, belief in God, offers a more adequate explanation than atheism does for the following aspects of reality, like the beginning of the universe. You know, the universe had to be... How many people were here, attended my talk that I gave at the last Worldview Conference? One, two, three, four. Okay, four. Okay. For you, a lot of this is going to be a rehashing of what I spoke about there. And it's going to be a lot more rushed here. But with the beginning of the universe, we know that the universe had a beginning based on the second law of thermodynamics. And this tells us that even though the amount of energy in the universe remains constant, it changes forms, and as it changes forms, it becomes less and less usable. Okay, so basically the universe is not running out of energy. This is the same amount of energy that's been here since creation, but it's running out of usable energy. Okay, so eventually we'll reach a point where all the energy in the universe will have been used up. That will mark the end of the universe. But that means if you go backwards far enough into the past, you'd reach a point where all the energy in the universe was in a useful state. That would mark the beginning of the universe. So the second law of thermodynamics is all we need to scientifically establish that the universe had a beginning. Still, atheists chose to ignore that, okay? And they would say, well, the universe doesn't need a cause because it never had a beginning. And then what happened was Edwin Hubble in 1929 found that the universe was expanding in all different directions, and atheistic evolutionists assume that what's going on now is going on throughout all eternity in the past. Well, if the whole universe is expanding in all directions, much like that of an explosion, if you go backwards in time, eventually the universe gets smaller and smaller until the universe would reach a point of infinite density or a point of dimensionless space. Those are the words that they use. And when you talk about something physical, to have a point of dimensionless space, that means a physical point that takes up no dimensions in space. Well, then it takes up no space. It's not there. Go back far enough in the past, the universe wasn't there, and then boom, it came into existence. Also, a point of infinite density, something can only be finitely dense or small. If it's small without limit, again, it's not there. So the Big Bang model, I don't even adhere to the Big Bang model, but most evolutionists do, and many Christians do as well. But the Big Bang model teaches the same thing as the second law of thermodynamics, and that is that the universe had a beginning. At one time it was not, and then boom, it exploded into existence. Now, evolutionists since the 1930s, the leading atheist philosophers since the 1930s have had to let go. You get a few guys who kind of would cling against all the scientific evidence to a universe without a beginning, like the late Carl Sagan. But most atheists, I debated Dr. Michael Martin from Boston University, one of America's leading atheists, and he stated in that debate that the universe popped into existence totally out of nothing, totally without a cause. Quentin Smith, another one of America's leading atheists, when he debated William Lane Craig in Theism, Atheism, and Big Bang Cosmology, they turned it into a book. On page 135 of that book, he claims that the universe popped into existence totally out of nothing, totally without a cause. So, very few atheist leaders are saying that the universe was always here. Today, you know, an atheist won't admit this defeat. They used to say the universe doesn't need a cause because it didn't have a beginning. Now they're saying the universe had a beginning, but it still doesn't need a cause. So the debate is between the Christian, who says in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and the atheist, who is now saying in the beginning the universe just popped into existence totally out of nothing, totally without a cause. You know, I tried to explain to some of my Japanese students. Now, these were exchange students. They were just there for the experience. They didn't receive a grade. Their English wasn't that good. And so I used to tell them that I have the power to lift weights. Okay? And they would nod and stuff, but they understood what I was saying. But then I said, I do not have the power to make everything. And they came from a Buddhist background. So I told them, nothing can't even lift weights. How could nothing, doesn't even have the power that I have, make everything? Okay? And I think their response was, it's a miracle. And I said, no, I can have miracles. I have a God who does miracles. Nothing doesn't do miracles. And so it's like I said at that conference, nothing is nothing, therefore nothing can do nothing, therefore nothing can cause nothing. If something had an absolute beginning, something else had to cause it to come into existence. Now, some atheists are arguing the universe caused itself to come into existence. That's absurd, because they're claiming that the universe pre-existed its own existence in order to bring its own existence about. You can't pre-exist your own existence. Before your existence, you don't exist. So wherever the case, the beginning of the universe, it's far more reasonable to argue that that an eternal being, i.e. God, brought the universe into existence than it is to believe that the universe popped into existence out of nothing, totally without a cause. The continued existence of the universe, this is the way Thomas Aquinas argued. Let me see if I can... Well, I'm not going to be able to do it justice. I can't do any of these arguments justice, but... Okay, let's assume that everything that exists... Let's assume that everything that exists has the possibility of non-existence. Okay? Everything that exists has the possibility of non-existence. That would mean if everything that exists is contingent. Contingent means it's dependent on something else for its continued existence. Okay? if it didn't depend on anything, then it would be necessary existence. Okay? A totally independent.
Supposed to be a need.
Okay, so let's assume that there is no God of necessary existence, and that everything exists is dependent on something else for its continued existence. So I depend upon water and food and shelter for my continued existence, okay? You take the water and the food away, and then I die, okay? So I'm a continued existence. I don't have to exist. There was a time when I did not exist, and now I exist. So it's possible for me to not exist. So you have another way of saying this one is possible existence, whereas this is necessary existence. Okay? So if everything that exists is contingent or dependent on other things for its continued existence, then it has the possibility of not existing. You take away a few factors, food and water, boom, I don't exist. Okay? So we go on in the future, and if everything is contingent, if everything is dependent, if everything has the possibility of non-existence, given enough time, every possibility will be actualized. Okay? So let's say there's one scenario, probably lots of them, let's say there's one scenario, if this scenario were to obtain, if this scenario were to come about, then everything with the possibility of non-existence would cease to exist. Okay? So given enough time, every possibility will be actualized, and since everything has the possibility of non-existence, nothing will exist. But the problem, though, if you go backwards in time, that same scenario would have obtained in the past to where nothing would exist. But from nothing, nothing comes, but something now is, therefore something has to be eternal to ground the existence of all contingent, dependent existence. So in other words, the only way to explain the existence of contingent, dependent, possible beings is by acknowledging the existence of a necessary, totally independent being that grounds the continuing existence of all contingent beings. Okay? You know, the crazy thing is, here we're looking at, it's the cause for your continuing existence more than it is the cause for the beginning of your existence. So it's existential causality. It's like simultaneous causation. So it's not like parents causing a baby to come into existence. It's more like you causing your reflection in the mirror. It's simultaneous causation. You move your head, the reflection is gone. Pretty tough to prove, but you move your head and the reflection isn't there. I could go look and check it out for you, but then my reflection would be there. So the continuing existence, you know, it'd be like, you know, the universe cannot account for its origin, and it can't account for its continuing to stay in existence. The design and order found in the universe, we talked about, the design and order found in a single-celled animal is enough to fill a large library with volumes. You can't get that amount of information by chance. Even one sentence, I believe there was a note about the coffee and the coffee mugs out there, okay? And I don't know if Denise wrote that, but you know, nobody's going to look and say, look at that, that's really strange. Somebody was just scribbling on a piece of paper, maybe making sure their pen was going to write, and it formed a pattern that seems to give information about the coffee and the donuts or whatever. Or actually, the donut information, I think, was assumed, hopefully correctly. But Yeah, we presupposed that donuts were for us. But whatever the case, this is a small sentence that when I spoke at the Worldview conference, the Apologetics conference, I talked about if I were eating, you know, I'm a Raider fan. Pastor Hutcherson is a Seahawks fan. He used to play for the Seahawks. And but if I had breakfast at his house and I ate before he did, because, you know, Raider fans get up earlier in the morning and it'd be harder working than Seahawks fans, but and then he sat down to eat. If I had like alphabet cereal and he sat down to eat and on the table it said Seahawks stink, Raiders rule, he's not going to think, boy, isn't that something? Fernandez spilled some of the alphabet cereal and he just happened to spell out a message. I mean, you know, when you drive down in Southern California, you see Hollywood spelled out on the side of the thing. You don't think, isn't that amazing? Somebody just threw those letters down and it spelled out a word. No, it doesn't take a whole lot of information before. We could take letters and just throw them on the floor, and maybe after, you know, if you take 50 letters, we might find the word bat or cat or go in there, and we'd say, oh, you know, that got here by chance. But to take, you know, 500 letters and just throw them out, and then to find somewhere in the midst of those a full sentence, like Seahawks stink, Raiders rule, no, we're going to know that somebody shuffled the deck. It's intelligence right there. That's why when scientists find an arrowhead, they know that there was an arrowhead maker. When they find a vase, there was a vase maker. William Paley argued when we find a watch, it lets us know there was a watchmaker. Then William Paley argued the human eye is much more complex and highly designed than a watch, therefore there has to be a creator of the human body and the human eye. So the design and order in the universe, you know, it's explosions, as you mentioned earlier. If they want to try to go to the Big Bang model, you know, if this television gets 12 channels, 12 stations, if we blow it up, it's not going to get a 13th or a 14th. Okay? It's not going to work at all. Explosions take things from a state of order and complexity to a state of chaos. Okay? And the design and order found in the universe argue for the existence of an intelligent designer. You know, you could look at erosion on a cliff and try to, and you could account for that through natural causes, but you can't look at the four faces on Mount Rushmore and say, well, that just got here by chance. Okay? No, it was an intelligent designer designed that, and they chiseled it out and used dynamite and everything to make it, but whatever the case, so the design and the order in the universe is a strong clue to the existence of God. You know, how many explosions would it take in a print shop before out would pop a Webster's Dictionary? It's not going to happen. Okay? It takes intelligent intervention. It takes intelligent design. So on these, what I'm doing is, at the beginning of the universe, it's more reasonable to believe God created the universe. The continuing existence of the universe, it's more reasonable to believe in God than to be an atheist. The design and order in the universe, it's more reasonable to believe in God. The possibility of human knowledge, human reason. To this day, even Michael Martin writes it in his work, Atheism, a Philosophical Justification, that atheists do not have any agreed upon epistemology, any agreed upon theory of knowledge. Okay? Well, the reason why they don't agree on one is because they don't have a good theory of knowledge. If they assume there is no God, they can't explain how man knows. Now, most Christians don't have a really solid theory of knowledge either. Okay? But we don't have to explain how we know. If we know who made us and who made the world and the reasons why he made us. Okay? So if we know the who, that a rational God created us in his image so that we're rational beings and created the universe in a way that makes sense so that through reason we could really find truth in the universe in which we live, then we don't have to worry about the how. Now, we'll look into it, and our Christian philosophers will study it, but we don't have to answer the how if we know the who. Okay? If you throw the who out of the picture, okay, then you have a tough time explaining how man can know. And if you don't know, you know, well, we know that we know because God, the ultimate knower, created us to be knowers. You throw the ultimate knower out the window, all you're left with is, well, how do we even know that we know? We think we know things. I think you end up with Immanuel Kant's dilemma. He tries to throw God out and to just reason to God's existence from there, and he acknowledged that he failed in doing that. But basically, Immanuel Kant argued we could know reality as it appears to us, but not reality as it is. Okay? And I think that's the best that secular philosophy can do. Once you throw God out the window, all you can know is reality as you think it is, reality as it appears to you, but you have no guarantee that it's reality as it is. Okay? Now, having said that, there's a problem. Hegel pointed this out, but Immanuel Kant, when he argued we can know reality as it appears to us, but not reality as it is, we can ask him, is that a statement about reality? If it's not a statement about reality, who cares? If it is a statement about reality, then we can know reality as it is. So it's a self-refuting statement. But whatever the case, I think the only way to escape that self-refuting conclusion is to acknowledge the existence of God. The existence of universal, eternal, unchanging truth, just like Augustine argued, that really doesn't make sense unless they exist as the eternal, unchanging ideas in the mind of God. The reality of universal, eternal, unchanging moral laws. Let me see if I have. Well, it might be in the back. I might be able to. I'm looking for a page on refuting moral relativism. Might be in here, might not. I know how to go. Here it is. Just a few pages past this, about five or six, maybe more. But refuting moral relativism. Moral relativism is the belief each individual decides for themselves what is right and what is wrong. Moral absolute says that there are some moral laws that apply to all people at all times and all places. Even atheists acknowledge the existence of moral laws. The question is, where do they come from? Okay? And so, the atheist to say, well, the moral law ultimately comes from each individual. Each individual decides what is right or what is wrong for himself or herself. The problem there, though, because then one individual cannot condemn the actions of another individual as wrong. Okay? So if we want to condemn the actions of Adolf Hitler or Osama bin Laden, we have to appeal to a moral standard above individuals. So then the atheist could say, okay, well, maybe it's the society. Society decides. But then there's a problem, because one society, like America, cannot condemn the actions of another society as wrong. We can't condemn the actions of Nazi Germany. We can't condemn the actions of the Taliban. Okay? But we want, even atheists, even more relativists, want to condemn the actions of the Taliban and Nazi Germany. So then they can say, well, we're appealing to world consensus. Yeah, well, that's not a real good standard for morality. World consensus has been way out to lunch in the past. At one time, the woman had no rights. She was considered property of the man. Well, we say, well, they were wrong. Okay? At one time, slavery was the name of the game. It was perfectly permissible. Well, the world consensus was wrong. At one time, the world consensus was that the world is flat. World consensus was wrong. So it doesn't have a really good track record. That's number one. Number two, sometimes it's hard to even figure out what the world consensus would be. What is the world consensus? I don't walk around with a little voting gadget where I vote on every issue. So the world consensus, I guess, is what the United Nations tells me it is. Well, I don't trust all those guys in the United Nations. So I'm not sure they know what I'm thinking better than I know what I'm thinking. They're convinced they do. But, you know, most of the time we can't even attain to a world consensus. And when the atheist tries to make the world a better place to live, what he's saying is, I don't like the world consensus. I think it's wrong. And the atheist will say, you know, the world consensus was worse in the past than it is now, and we made some improvements. Women's rights, abolishing slavery, but we want to make the world an even better place to live in the future. See, now you got a real problem here for the atheist. Because now you're acknowledging a moral standard above all individuals, above all societies, above any world consensus, and it's a moral, if you want to judge the actions of the past, it's a moral standard that does not change with time. And so what we need is a moral lawgiver above all individuals, above all societies, above any world consensus that does not change with time. And so basically, just from the existence of absolute moral laws, we can make a strong case that an absolute moral lawgiver must exist above all individuals, all societies, any world consensus, and it's an eternal, unchanging moral lawgiver. Okay, the meaning of life, purpose in life. You realize if God does not exist and there's no life after death, no punishments or rewards, that it would be irrelevant whether you lived your life like Mother Teresa and helped innocent people, or if you lived your life like Adolf Hitler and slaughtered innocent people. A million years after you die, you will have ceased to exist. Every person you ever influenced, for good or for bad, will have ceased to exist. And eventually the whole universe is going to blow up and cease to exist. It's totally irrelevant whether you lived your 70, 80, 90 years helping innocent people or slaughtering innocent people. Okay? But even the atheist acknowledges there's a difference between Adolf Hitler and the Mother Teresa's of our day. And but basically, just to find meaning in the little things that we do, let alone the big things that we do, necessitates the existence of God and eternity. Anybody know, probably I would think the earliest argument for God's existence based on the absurdity of life without God. Yeah, I'll give you a hint. It's probably in your favorite book. Paul kind of keys on one where he, 1 Corinthians 15:33 or 32, he says that Jesus isn't raised and the dead are not raised. If the dead are not raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. But there's something that, and he's quoting some ancient Greek philosophers, but there's something that goes back to about 900 B.C., the book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon, he writes that everything under the sun is meaningless, striving after the wind. It makes no sense at all. Everything we do is just irrelevant. It really doesn't matter. You can build big buildings. After you die, you leave it to your son, and he's an idiot, and the buildings are no longer standing. Your wealth is gone. Everything occurs, even your accomplishment things occur over and over again. There's nothing new under the sun. And Solomon tries everything. Wealth, building projects, sex, wine, wisdom, nothing makes sense until he starts saying little things like God has put eternity in our hearts. Okay? See, in light of eternity, time makes sense. There is no eternity, time is meaningless. And then at the end he says the conclusion of all this is fear God and obey his commands. And then he says, that not just our actions, but even our thoughts, God will call into judgment. So in the beginning, if you look at everything under the sun, you don't put God in the equation, even big building projects like building the temple are irrelevant. They don't have meaning. Once you put God in the equation, then even little thoughts that you have eternal consequence. See, that's where I argued against Michael Martin. By the way, you can go to our website, biblicaldefense.org, and click onto that and just read the debate. It's in written form. But I kept telling him that there's no meaning with a capital M, then all the meanings with little m that you have in the end are dust in the wind. But he's just like, oh, no, you know. Basically, his view is that a guy can make his car meaning in life, his meaning in life. And I'm saying that's not good enough, because the car is going to rust and the guy's going to die. So, it's like getting back to our little eternal line here. If you're going to cease to exist over here, okay, and you didn't exist, you just popped into existence here, then this little line segment, okay, doesn't amount to anything, because in the end you're going to have eternity of nothing here, eternity of nothing there. We've got to anchor time and eternity for life to have meaning. There's really no way around it. And, it's... What should we say? You know, well done now, good and faithful servant, to Bertrand Russell, atheist who died in 1970. It's like, hey, if he was right, he doesn't exist. You know, he can't even say, wow, at least I influenced the world for good. What? You're gone. And the world that you supposedly influenced for the quote-unquote good, even though you don't believe in good, eventually that's going to cease to exist too. And in fact, the strongest statement that I found in print to the absurdity of life without God is a quote from Bertrand Russell. I'll give you a couple quotes on this. One is from Blaise Pascal. I'll read that first. And this is in both of my books, The God of Sits Enthroned and No Other Gods, in different places, though. But Pascal says this: imagine a number of men in chains, all under the sentence of death, some of whom are each day butchered in the sight of others. Those remaining see their own condition and that of their fellows, and looking at each other with grief and despair, await their turn. This is an image of the human condition. He says we come into life and we all know we're going to die. And then he says later on, so what do we do about it? We go out dancing. You bring up the word diversion. We divert our attention. You know, it's like he says that we run towards the edge of a cliff with our hand over our eyes so we don't see where we're going, because we don't want to face it. You know, we go to other people's funerals and we lie to ourselves and say, yeah, this will never be me. This happens to everybody else, but it doesn't happen to me. And so what Pascal is saying, life is absurd. It's one big cruel joke unless we can find deliverance from death. And he argues that the wise man is going to seek that deliverance throughout his life, and if he finds Christ, he'll find that deliverance. Now, Bertrand Russell, the British atheist, he wrote in his Why I'm Not a Christian this statement. It's like a run-on sentence, not even a complete sentence, but whatever the case, that man is the product of causes which had no prevision of the end they were achieving, that his origin, his growth, his hopes and fears, his loves and his beliefs are but the outcome of accidental collocations of atoms, that no fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought, feeling can preserve an individual life beyond the grave, that all the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system, and that the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. And so Russell writes this, and then he tells his followers to build their philosophy of life upon this firm foundation of unyielding despair. So Bertrand Russell's saying, hey, everything that man has ever accomplished is someday going to cease to exist. It's all going to die. And he even talks about it, probably tongue-in-cheek, as unyielding despair. No, Mr. Russell, it's not unyielding. It's not a tongue-in-cheek thing, unyielding despair. Unyielding despair is what you get if there is no God. If it's all going to blow up, it's like Bertrand Russell saying, telling his atheist colleague, build a nice statue. Oh, great, I'm going to build a nice statue. And what's going to be done with the statue? And then Bertrand Russell says, we're going to blow it up. Well, then I don't want to build a nice statue. Maybe I want to just eat and drink for tomorrow I die, but I don't want to build a nice statue. It makes no sense to build a nice statue. If God doesn't exist, you guys are really wasting your time here. Okay? The fact of the matter is, though, I took one debate at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill campus. I was the token theist to debate atheist Jeffrey J. Lauder, who's a major atheist conference with hundreds of atheists from all over the world. Okay? They don't believe God exists, so I told them. I said, why do you even get out of bed in the morning? Why do you put your bumper stickers of the Darwin fish? It makes sense if I do the Jesus fish because I believe Jesus saves. You believe there's no God, so you're going to proclaim that from the rooftops? Why? You're going to travel halfway around the world to go to a conference to celebrate the non-existence of God and the fact that when we die, we cease to exist for all eternity? I said, do you really believe that? If you really believe that, I don't think any of you would be here right now. And then I realized, whoa, you know, these are, you know, some of the world's leading scientists and philosophers. Maybe I ought to just keep my mouth shut. So I just shut up. And I thought I was going to get heckled, and there was nothing but silence. Nothing but silence. I even felt the Spirit of God moving, like, you know, deep down inside. They really, you know, God doesn't exist. Why are we playing this atheist game? Okay? Even Albert Camus, he was Jean-Paul Sartre's friend, the French existentialist, the nihilist, believed no meaning, no God, no meaning in life, no truth. And so even he used to, he had his myth of Sisyphus. He thought about, you know, the Greek god like trying to raise this, move this stone uphill only to have it roll down again, and just keeps doing it. And that's the absurdity of life without God. And Camus believed there was no God, so he said the only question philosophers have to answer is, why not suicide? Because life really doesn't make sense. Nazis took Jews in a concentration camp during World War II, and they made them, they gave them shovels. And they told them, move that mound of dirt from there over to this other place, you know, 30, 40 yards away. And the Jews actually were grateful. Because finally you're giving our life meaning. You're giving us something important to do. And so they moved the mound of dirt 20 or 30 yards. But then the next day the Nazis gave them shovels and said, okay, now move that mound of dirt back where it was before. And the day after, move it back. So from point A to point B, back and forth. Back and forth, back and forth, and one by one, the Jewish prisoners began to break down, have nervous breakdowns, and they just drop their shovels, drop to the ground and weep and hold their head in their hands, because the whole job was given to the Jews to show them how absurd their existence was, how meaningless their existence was in a concentration camp. And they got the point home. But the fact of the matter is, if God does not exist, that's all we all, you know. You have a dictator rules, and then there's a revolution, and he gets knocked off, and then you have freedom. And then eventually a dictator rises to power again, and things just go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. The Friedrich Nietzsche rejected God. He said we needed a new myth. So he predicted the myth of eternal recurrence, that the given an infinite amount of time. He didn't believe the universe had a beginning. He was pre-Big Bang. The atoms, the molecules in the universe will reshuffle, and so every so often they'll be in the exact same. All we are is mere molecules of motion, if atheism is true. So Nietzsche says, eventually, given enough time, we'll be right back here for the same lecture over and over again, an infinite number of times through all eternity. You have this eternal merry-go-round. The problem that, you know, Christian philosophers have asked Nietzsche, they've thrown out to him, is what's the difference between your eternal recurrence and hell? If things just go on over and over and over and over again, that sounds a lot like the biblical concept of hell. It's meaningless existence. So once you take God out of the equation, there is no meaning in life. Reason to be optimistic about the future. Just because we get out of bed in the morning and we get washed up and we go and face the day implies that we believe there's hope. There's a reason to get up in the morning. But if human history is nothing but a bunch of people who either accomplish great things or don't accomplish much,